We know hunting for good coffee can be frustrating and time-consuming. And with all the confusing labels out there, it's hard to know that what you are buying is actually mindfully sourced and truly making a difference in people's lives. That's why we put together our Perpetual Joy coffee subscription. Over the last 15 years, Joe Bean Coffee has built friendships with award-winning coffee farmers, ones we trust to consistently bring us amazing coffee year after year. Coffee tastes best at the peak of harvest, which is why we run our program like a CSA, regularly sending you a rotating selection of in-season coffee. You pick how many bags and how often you need it. We do the rest. And you can feel good knowing you're directly supporting small-scale coffee farmers. Go to JoeBeanRoasters.com for details.
This is Evan Dawson. If you like conversations that take you beyond the headlines, join me on Connections. Every day, we dig into the issues shaping Rochester with the people living them, researching them, even trying to change them. No hot takes, no shouting most of the time. Just real conversations to keep you involved in your community. Listen to Connections wherever you get your podcasts.
Yo, good morning. Thank you so much for listening. I appreciate it. Thank you for being here today. I think it's a good stretch right now. I mean, man, Brian Nicholson, Red Jacket, Charles Corby, Pittsford Dairy last 2 weeks. Today, author, Adam Eaton. Next 2 weeks, Jen Newman, Young Lion, John Erlob, Rohrbach. By the way, I was there to capture the moment Jen Newman tried for the first time her baby, Young Lion, as it had been run by Rohrbach. The first manufacturing run that Rohrbach did of Young Lion, Jen was there. I was there. Jen was there. I witnessed the whole thing. It's actually, next week's episode actually opens with that. So it's something really cool to look forward to. Also, John and Jen, two separate episodes, but there will be plenty of a crossover where we talk both of them at the same time, telling the story of how they came together to do that deal. If you don't know, Rohrbach purchasing the rights to, I guess, purchasing the brand, not just the rights to, purchasing the actual intellectual property, the brand of Young Lion Brewing, which, of course, Jen built. But again, that's the next two podcasts. Getting ahead of myself. Today, Adam Eaton's going to be great. Before we get to Adam, I got to tell you, I'm struggling, man. I've had a tough week or so here at Craft Cannery. Now, it's nothing to do with the business is doing great. The people are great. But we just had a few things. First of all, one of my absolute favorite people here, one of our most key team members, a young man named Anthony, his father passed away unexpectedly. And this is just an absolute tragedy, right? Anthony's young. His father was young. His father was young. I don't even think his father was 60. Full of life, full of energy. Passed away. Got the C, found out too late. Even if it wasn't too late, it's one of those ones that I don't know what you can do. It's just a death sentence. And it's just one of those things that makes you go, why do bad things happen to good people? That's killing me. The second thing is just, I just feel overwhelmed recently. I get it. Listen, nobody wants to hear the owner of a business complained, but I'm just telling you, whatever. I'm being human for a second. I've just been overwhelmed at work recently. And today I had this opportunity. I had like 6 hours free, no meetings, no phone calls, nothing. Just 6 hours, lock myself in an office. I do so. Of course, there's knocks on the door every 2 minutes, fires to put out, whatever. That's the job. I'm not complaining. Then just when I'm feeling like I'm getting buckled in, all fires have been put out, an FDA inspector shows up, right? Like, and look, we did great. We did great. We got an A on the inspection, right? So it went great. But it's 4 or 5 hours. It's stressful. It's a lot. It's a lot. And by the way, for those of you who know the food business, I'm not exaggerating when I say FDA. We have New York State Department of Agriculture. We call it Eggs and Markets. That is who inspects us. But today, the inspector was an Eggs and Markets inspector being contracted by the FDA, which is like a little bit more. It's funny because the only other time we've ever had an FDA inspection was the day before I left on a cruise for my 40th birthday. So that was the one good thing is it gave me good memories of that. Anyway, I hate to come on here and be like, oh, life is hard, but you know, it's been a tough week. Also, I know I've been telling you by the end of this year, I want to hire a salesperson. So I'm trying to build a sales structure. And as I've been doing that, it's just so much rejection. Cold things going cold, trails going cold, hoops to jump through, hoops on hoops on hoops to jump through. And I don't know. It's just hard. It's just been a hard week. Look, it was great before that. It'll be great again soon. And even this week, the complaints I have are tiny, menial complaints. Life is good. My children are happy and healthy. My wife is happy and healthy. My business is happy and healthy. I've got a lot to be happy about. So I'm not trying to get on here and be like, woe is me. I just needed a friend to talk to for 5 minutes. So I hope I didn't drag us down too much. I'm going to shut up. We got to bring this thing back. Let's get the energy back in the room, baby. You know how we're going to do it? Two ways. Number one, intro song, full version, Elvio Fernandez. Number two, author Adam Eaton. Enjoy.
Are you recording? Yeah.
Let's actually brought you
a gift. This is the cover of the book, Black is Beautiful.
Who is she?
Her name is Awal Du, and she is the model that inspired the book, actually.
Wow. Hold that mic right up. Get right up in there. Yeah.
Okay.
And where's she from?
She's from Ghana.
Beautiful. Where are you from?
I was born and raised in Rochester.
You're from Rochester? Yeah. From Rochester. I want to talk about your story. So this is the cover of the book, though, right?
Yes, she's the cover.
Gorgeous.
It includes like the title and everything, but the print just features the model.
Okay. When I do these podcasts, granted there's no video on this, right? But when I do these, I will always put a picture a lot of times of the person I'm interviewing.
Yeah.
In this case, maybe I'll, so that people know what I'm fawning over right now, I'll put that picture maybe as the like title picture for this podcast.
That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And it's Black History Month. Mm-hmm. So I think people would like that.
Absolutely. So where were you born and raised then? What neighborhood?
I was born in Highland Hospital.
Oh, that's
where
our kids were.
Where were we living during? I think we were living on, my mom always talks about Burr Street in the city. But like inner city for sure. Okay. Not too far from downtown probably.
Well, what school did you go to? Like elementary school. What school?
So I was in number 12 school until fourth grade. And then there's a program in Rochester called Urban Suburban.
Yes, I'm aware. Yeah.
And so city students can actually go to suburban schools. So from fourth grade through 12th grade, I went to the Penfield School District.
Do you know how Penfield was selected in that case? Did your family choose that or did you just get placed? Or
so my older brother also was in the urban suburban program and he went to Brockport.
Okay.
So it probably was the idea that maybe Brockport didn't have any more spots available.
Got it.
So Penfield was an open school.
What was it like going to a different school than your brother? Were you, I mean, what's the age difference?
5 years older.
Okay, so maybe you wouldn't have been.
Well, yeah, because he's 5 years older, especially during the early days, because he's older than us. So it was like we didn't get closer until we got older.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So back then, so it wasn't a big deal back then. You're like, hey, you know what? Better off that he goes somewhere different.
And then me and my younger sister are just 2 years apart. So me and her went to Penfield together.
Well, that's great because then you're closer in age. You can maybe ride the bus together or get a ride to school together. And you see each other in the hallways. You got a friend and, you know, you got somebody. What was that experience like? Do you remember, first of all, prior, so I speak English. Do you remember prior to fourth grade when you were going to city schools? And then what was the, was it a shell shock to go out to the suburbs? Or did you not even really notice? You're too young to notice a difference.
I remember actually number 12 school was a very good school. It was very like arts driven at the time.
Mm-hmm. What's the name of that school? Do you know?
James P.B. Duffy.
Okay, got it, yeah.
Is that still the name?
I'm not sure, but I've heard that before.
I know they changed the names a lot, but it used to be James P.B. Duffy. And I remember it being like filled with creativity. I think maybe that's why I was so drawn to the arts and creativity, because at the time, number 12 school was very artistic and like had a lot of arts-based programming. And I remember being in like the chorus and the art classes, stuff like that.
So did you ever get a chance to talk to your parents, or have they ever talked about, so then if you're clicking so well in that school and it's right up your alley, why join the urban suburban program? Why not just stick with the school number 12?
I think what my parents felt and what a lot of parents currently feel about the city school districts is that elementary, maybe through like middle school, the schools are okay, you know, like they're pretty good. But once you get like to middle school, high school, that's when a lot of the problems come, a lot of the ideas of like violence and just opportunities maybe are changed somehow. So I think my parents felt that. And then the urban suburban schools have like a deadline that you can enter the school. Actually, I think it's sixth grade. So if you don't enter the program by sixth grade, you're no longer able to enter it. So you have to enter before sixth grade to be a part of the program.
Yeah. So they were getting ahead. They were like, okay, we
planning
we
think, for the future.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you show your first signs of artistic excellence? I mean, are you in elementary? Did your mom
in elementary for sure?
Did your parents tell you stories of like, oh, your doodles looked amazing, right?
I actually have. I have a lot of the doodling books.
Yeah.
And then I remember in number 12 school, we made like a book about our life, and I still have it. Like you had to draw. Like it prompts you with like questions about where do you live, what does your house look like, and I still have that book of like drawings about myself.
It looks good.
It's pretty good, I guess.
It's impressive.
For second grade, third grade, those ideas.
When was it the first time though that somebody said to you, whether it was your parents or a teacher or something, somebody said, hey Adam, this is really good. This looks really good.
It was probably, I was in chorus in number 12 school, I remember. Mm-hmm. And then I was selected to do a solo 1 year in like the school chorus, the final show they do at the end of the year. So I think around that time is when people like noticed me that I had talent. Mm-hmm. But I think I had talent in multiple mediums. Mm-hmm. Like I did like to draw, but I also like to sing. So those ideas.
And so you eventually then you go to Penfield and that's where you, I guess, spend middle school and high school. Yeah. And was art embraced there? Did you feel like you were getting developed there as an artist?
Yeah, Penfield actually is known for their arts programming.
Wonderful.
And so I took like painting courses, pottery. They had jewelry making. I remember taking like a digital media type of class, photography course. And then throughout my high school, I was in the chorus.
One thing that I grew up in a really small town in Ohio, like rural Ohio, and we didn't have painting or pottery as classes.
Really?
They weren't even offered. No, it wasn't even offered. We had art class. It was just called art class, you know, and there might be like a day where we learned about pottery, but I don't think we ever made pottery or anything like that. So I'm jealous in a way because I wonder, I look at like a little rural high school like mine, and I wonder if there were potential artists there who just got squandered because it wasn't available to them. so where I want to turn that into a question is, when you were a teenager, did you think art as a career was possible? Were you optimistic about that?
So I believe that Penfield like valued the arts like as maybe as a hobby, as like a creative practice, like in your day-to-day life, and they, and I think like the connection between arts and education, but I don't think they really pushed the idea of like arts as a creative career. Mm-hmm. So I remember my advisors and things like that never mentioned the idea of like having art be a creative career, even like, I don't know, media design or photography or like advertising can be creative career. So I actually wanted to go to college for like to be a teacher, or just the idea that I think during that time, really people promoted college and the idea of like you had to be a doctor, a lawyer, those type of.
Can I ask how old you are? I'm trying to figure out if we're close at all.
34.
Okay, I'm 42. We're not that close, but close-ish.
Yeah,
I had the same experience. I remember that I don't feel like there were a lot of options open to me. It was like, go to college or you're a bum. Mm. That was what I felt like was coming from my counselors and frankly my parents as well.
True.
And so like I don't think anyone ever would have told you you could be an artist. In fact, my mother was a third grade teacher for about 30 years, and she actually says that one of her biggest regrets was that early in her career, when she would see a kid doodling in class, she would stop them and say like, hey, you're supposed to be paying attention, we're doing this. And she said later in her career she got wise to the fact that like, hey, that's, that kid is letting out their creativity right now. Yeah. I'm going to tell the art teacher that young Adam is interested in art. She said that was something that came with wisdom, though. Early in her career, it was just like, put that pen down, stop that.
I think that's true just like in American culture in general.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of times they don't really advertise the arts or have the arts as a career, or really like maybe make the arts feel like it's an important part of our daily life and how important it is to our life. Like even TV, movies, those are all artistic, creative passions, and even advertising and media, social media, those ideas can actually be very lucrative careers. And I think what we're seeing now is maybe the world is understanding how important like those ideas are, like creating content, creating TV shows, how people now can be content creators on YouTube and Instagram. Yeah. And those are really just creative avenues and have become a career, especially in our digital age.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that, that you know, TikTok wasn't around when I was young, right? And social media didn't come around until I was about in college. And the idea that you could just put anything, I mean, podcast, right? Like podcasts, YouTube channels, like people can just create content and put it out there. And the good is everybody gets a shot. Anybody can get a shot. Anybody can upload a video to YouTube and say, here, check out my show or whatever you want to do, which is cool. But on the other hand, you know, the content isn't necessarily being curated or filtered. So there's some bad content out there. There's some good content out there. There's some hateful content. There's some kind content. There's less filter, I guess. But I still like the fact that you can, if you are determined to have the Pauly Guglielmo podcast or the Adam Eaton art, I don't know, television hour, whatever. Like, you can just do it. Nobody's going to stop you. YouTube, podcast, whatever it is. That is a beautiful thing about the world we live in now that sometimes young people don't realize 30 years ago just was not a thing. It wasn't a thing when I was a kid. So anyway, you mentioned maybe becoming a teacher. Mm. If I came up to you on graduation day in Penfield, I said, Adam, what are you going to be when you grow up? What's your answer?
I would have said I was going to go to college to be a teacher. So that's what I was going to do.
What subject? Art?
I didn't know what subject, but probably working with like young students, probably elementary up to middle school. I knew that those were, in my mind, those were easier kids to work with.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, younger kids in the early education.
So you would have said teaching, but then what actually does happen? You go to college, what happens for the next few years?
So I went to MCC for liberal arts, and then it was actually very, college was very difficult for me. I don't know why, like I very much struggled. So I actually didn't finish the course, the college course at MCC. And so then I started working as like secretary work in the city school district, actually through an agency. But then I went to dental assisting, for a 1 year training program they had. But I didn't like that. So then I actually went to be a dental secretary, from my knowledge of being in school for dental assisting. And that I actually learned that I really like secretarial type work, mm-hmm. or like being assistant director, like assistant to the principal, those ideas. And so I started like building the path of like being a head secretary of one of the city school district. They have like a path where you can become the head secretary, which is basically like the principal secretary. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, that's like the person who really runs the school.
Oh yeah.
So oh, yeah. I always knew that I wanted like some autonomy, something where I had like a say in like my work. Yeah. And I believe that was going to be my path.
Yeah. Yeah. It reminds me, it's not a good comparison, but it reminds me of a nurse I know who said something like, doctors diagnose, nurses save lives. It's like you say, principal gets up and gives the speech, secretary runs this shit. You know what I mean?
They really do.
Yeah.
And what I learned from working in the city school district in the office is that they make a lot of the decisions, mm-hmm. and like how the school runs, when it's cleaned, all those ideas.
Yeah. So as you're going through this sort of traditional career path, what is art doing? Is art just kind of percolating in the background? And what type of art at this point, now you're a young adult, is photography? Is it? Are you drawing, painting? Like what's going on artistically then during that time?
So prior to a few years before 2019, I actually was like feeling very depressed. I remember that I was feeling like I was just like not feeling myself, feeling very down, isolating myself. And one day I was like wondering like, why am I feeling like this? And it had become like year after year idea. And one day I just thought about how I used to be in school and have all these artistic like avenues. And I was like, well, maybe I need to do that for my adult life. So in 2019, I actually took a photography class. I went to the Flower City Arts in Rochester. I was supposed to take their ceramic course. I just was like, I need to take some creative workshop, something. I know
it's
I need
building
to do
up inside
something your, creative. Some,
yeah.
And I didn't care what it was, yep. but I wanted to do ceramics or pottery at the Flower City Arts. But unfortunately, that class was sold out. So I took their photography class, and that's when I started learning about photography.
Oh my goodness, that's crazy. Like, how great your photography is. That's crazy to think that it started with being like, well, I wanted to do this other class, but it was sold out, so I took photography.
Yeah, I knew that I just needed something creative. I knew I needed something in my life where I can, like, express myself creatively. And so I started taking photos of, like, you know, local scenery, buildings, those type of things. But that wasn't so exciting for me. But then I remember just asking someone, like, if I could take a photo of them, like a person. And so that's when I started doing portrait photography. And also, I remember not liking to be outdoors a lot. I prefer being inside.
Me too.
And like the elements, I used to be outside with my camera, and like the bugs would get me, and it would be hot, and I would be like, "Oh, this is no fun."
Yeah.
I like photography, but I don't like being outdoors.
Yeah.
So that's when I started learning about studio photography.
Way better. And I'm with you, by the way. I don't like going outside either. I don't care. Every season, I've got some. So it's too cold right now. It's too hot in the summer. In the fall, there's bees. And in the spring, it's wet. I don't know. Exactly. Anyway, go on.
So I started. Someone helped me to get a studio, small studio space. I actually was sharing a space with another artist, Scott Hamilton, who actually became my mentor and helped me to learn about lighting. And from there, I just started, like, basically after work, after my 9-to-5, I worked at I actually went back to work at Monroe Community College as a secretary in the registration office. And so after that 9-to-5 job, I would go home and go to the studio. And I was happy. I started like getting happier and feeling better.
A few things to unpack here. So one is, it's interesting to me you're happier because you're probably at that point now you're working around the clock because you got a regular job, mm-hmm. and then you're going to what at that time was just a hobby, mm-hmm. and but you're happier despite the fact that you're working all those hours, which just goes back to that old adage of, if you're doing something you love, you never work a day in your life, right?
True.
Because it was fun. But can we unpack two things there?
Okay.
One, as I was reading about you, it said mm-hmm. that your journey required a lot of healing, that you're on a healing journey. That was on your website, I'm pretty sure. And then you also mentioned about being depressed, right? Is True. That what you're referring to?
Yes.
In the healing? Okay.
Depression, suicidal thoughts. Before 2019, I was like very overweight, like over 300 pounds. And
what do you weigh now?
About 215.
Man, oh, Matt, so. How'd you do it? I'm on the Wegovy right now, and it's going okay, but it kind of plateaued a little, but it's going okay.
So actually, when I started feeling better about my life, I actually had gastric bypass surgery.
Oh, so wonderful.
Yeah, so it's been a few years since that,
yeah.
and that helped a lot for me to lose weight. And I believe, like, just feeling better about yourself, like, you start like caring about your health, caring mm-hmm. about your wellness, understanding like maybe why you make certain decisions. And actually, creativity actually helped me to connect with people. So being in the community, photographing, working with models and artists, learning about the arts community. Because before then, I didn't know like that there were so many artists in Rochester mm-hmm. and so many like artist events, like open mics. And I knew about Flower City, but there's so many other art organizations so that I could connect with.
Yeah.
So learning about art and creativity helped me to like connect to the community, connect to people, and having friends, and those ideas, it just helped to improve my life in general.
So when you were having depressive thoughts, suicidal yeah. thoughts, things like that, mm-hmm. it sounds like you tied it to two things. One, your health, and mm-hmm. two, you didn't have enough connections in life. Maybe just you weren't around enough human beings. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, true. I believe that depression can have lots of different like causes.
Mm-hmm.
But for some reason, for me personally, I connected me having depression with me not being creative. And in my mind, that was what I needed to do. I needed to be creative, practice some form of art. And by me practicing some form of art, all the other things started to like open up. I started to connect with people. I started to like be outside more. Like the idea of like being around people more, then maybe you start caring about how you look and like those ideas. So I think for me, the idea of creativity and the power of the arts helped me to like change yeah. all the other parts of my life. That's why beautiful. I believe that art is so powerful. And I actually did a recent presentation to a group of women about the transformative power of the arts. And I really believe I connected my life to creativity and art being the reason why I was able to heal and get better.
That was beautiful and powerful, everything you just said. I want to share with you, if I could, can we get a little bit deep here for a second?
Okay.
So I have had depressive episodes in my life in therapy, and I've shared on the podcast before about it. And you have done a way more profound thing than I did to like get through it.
No,
and I still get these little episodes once in a while, and I don't think I've had severe depression. I always want to say I think I've had very mild depression compared to what I've heard other folks talk about. But it is for someone who hasn't experienced it. And maybe it's different for everyone, but I'll tell you what it's like for me. People immediately think it means that you're sad. And it really, for me, it wasn't sad. It was almost hopeless or helpless. It was like it didn't matter what I thought, said, or did. There was no point to anything. And I would just look out the window and drone, looking at the sky. I would just kind of, like in my head, I would just drone on about like, what is it all for? It's for nothing. There's no reason. There's no reason for any of this. Why am I even here? Which would lead, and I want to tell you this, because I it has to do with a suicidal thought. And I just want to know, if I bring that up, is that going to be triggering to you in any way?
No, I can talk about it.
We can talk. Sure. Okay. So I said on this podcast months, maybe even years ago, I said, I've never had a suicidal thought. Then I said, and I'm very blessed to have some very dedicated listeners to this podcast. Then I said on a whole different episode, I told a story about a podcast that I listened to about entrepreneurship, and that there was a guy who was in a plane crash. Mm-hmm. And he was telling the story about being in a plane crash. And it's really sad. It makes me want to cry saying this. So if I cry, I'm sorry, Adam.
No worries.
But he tells the story about that it was a plane crash where they're on the runway. They're going down the runway. They take off. They only get a few feet off the ground. They immediately come back down, and it's a crash. And it all happens so fast. Mm. And he said that he had three things that went through his head in the course of about 5 or 10 seconds. The first thought that went through his head is, oh no. You know, he goes, I'm going to die. I'm obviously going to die. This is a plane crash. The first thing that went through his head was, oh no, I'm going to miss my wife and children.
Yeah.
The second thing that went through his head was, oh, thank God I am done with the stress of my business.
Really?
And the third thing was, wait a second, that side's on fire. My side's not on fire, and I'm still alive. I think I might be able to get out of here. And all that happens in like 10, 15, 30 seconds or something. Mm-hmm. And I said that I could relate to that, that if I was ever about to die, if I was ever in a situation where it was imminent, where I think I'm going to die in the next 30 seconds, that I would have those same thoughts. I think I would go, oh my God, I'm going to miss my family so much. Thank God I'm done being stressed out over my job, really? Over my business. And that would be it. And then somebody said to me, they said, that was a suicidal thought. Mm. What do you think? Do you think that that's a suicidal thought that I had? Because I didn't think I ever had a suicide. I never thought about self-harm. And that's what I think as a suicidal thought. Mm. But the fact that I was like, thinking about
that. You're okay with the idea of, if this did happen to me,
it's a bit of
I would be okay with that.
That's
just how you felt.
You know what it is, actually? It's a little bit of there's a sentiment of put me out of my misery in there somewhere. And somebody told me, they said, that was a suicidal thought. You do have suicidal thoughts.
I think people feel that way maybe more often than you think. Just the idea of like, daily stress and anxiety is very difficult, especially now living in America, and there's like constant bad news and constant stressors. And you said you have a family that has, and you're a husband, and mm-hmm. a lot of times men even feel it more than others because they just have so much like to do, and people are always looking for them to be the provider and those ideas. So I think there's a spectrum of that. There are suicidal thoughts where maybe you feel like, this is a lot for me. Maybe if something bad happened, I wouldn't feel so sad. But then there are more extreme feelings of suicide, of course, where people actually try to commit right. harm to themselves. So I think maybe there's a spectrum to it, and we could be on that spectrum of that idea.
Yeah.
But it's just difficult. And I really believe that based on your story, you were saying that maybe some people don't have a passion or something that they're living for, because other people that maybe don't have those same feelings, like they immediately think of like all the things they're going to lose or all the things that they can live for.
Yeah.
And it seems like maybe you or other people first think about all the things that are causing them difficulties in their life.
Yeah. This is supposed to be about you and not me, so I'm sorry I'm in therapy for a second. Yeah, it's true, because this whole journey, right, this craft cannery thing has been amazing. Yeah. There's been high highs, and there's been a couple low lows. Mm. And I have noticed, and I hate this about myself, I have noticed that when we work really, really hard on something and it eventually gets accomplished, that the high lasts so much shorter of an amount of time off of finally accomplishing the high, as opposed to the low. When something goes bad around here, I let that last for a day or days, whereas the high, I'm like, it's fleeting. I'm like, okay, all right, check that off the box, that feels good. What's next?
That's common.
That's common. Okay.
I think it's very common. I actually read that there was a study about it. I'm sure you could look it up, but the idea that our brains a lot of times focus on negative things more than positive.
Yeah.
And I don't think they really know why that is, but you can actually change your brain to like not just look at life as more of like a journey, and that the journey is what's giving you the dopamine or the good feeling, not the completion of like the journey.
Miley
Cyrus. That's how I've changed my view.
Yeah.
That the high moments are great, but they're just part of the journey.
Miley like Cyrus said, oh, Miley Cyrus said it's all about the climb.
True. So Miley knows how to do it. She knows what life is all about.
Yeah.
The journey.
Okay. So I'm sorry. So for me, the way that I got out of all of this and the way that my therapist and I have worked on it is I always have to have something on my calendar that I'm looking forward to.
I like
always.
That idea. Yeah.
Like even just this week, and this podcast doesn't come out in real time. This will come out like two weeks from now. But mm-hmm. But anyway, this weekend, the Harlem Globetrotters are in town.
I saw that.
And I bought me and my son tickets to go to it just because like that gives me an afternoon with my son.
Yeah.
It's something to look forward to. And
welcome to Behind the Studio Door, where we dig into the vibrant creative landscape of Rochester, New York. Hi, I'm Molly Darling, and along with my co-host Christian Rivera and our fabulous producer Chris Lindstrom, it's my pleasure to guide you through the dynamic world of our local creative professionals. Each episode offers a unique glimpse into the studios of those who enrich our Rochester community with their artistic vision. Join us as we explore the diversity and talent in Rochester, revealing the compelling narratives and creative journeys that exist just beyond the studio door.
Hey everybody, it's Matt from the Anomaly Presents podcast. I want to take a moment to tell you about one of my favorite podcasts on the Limp Shore Podcast Network. It's Common Thread. Rory Van Grohl and Greg Benoit talk with their guests about how the values, philosophies, and sense of community found in hardcore punk has influenced the trajectory of their lived experiences in unexpected ways. It features organic discussions that illuminate how hardcore punk is the common thread that provides continuity throughout our lives and connects us to one another. It's Common Thread on the Lunch Door Podcast Network, anywhere you get your podcasts.
Just little things like that are how I get through it. For you, it was art. It was embracing.
True. But I do similar things now. So I'm actually working on a gallery show on April 20th with Jiva Theater.
Beautiful.
So my art and the series Black is Beautiful will be featured at Jiva Theater. It's called the Mondays at Jiva. So April 20th, people are invited to come 6 to 8 p.m. at Jiva Theater. And they'll see my art. There'll be live music. There'll mm-hmm. be food. So those are the type of things I do throughout the year. And I'm actually working on having at least 4 art gallery shows per year.
Fantastic.
And that helps me to like look forward to something every few months. And so in my mind, I'm really always planning for a good thing to come.
Same.
So I never have like a moment of like, something good is always coming for me. So yeah, that's how I look at it.
So, okay, so that is similar then. That's true. Common ground, exactly, yeah. So, okay, so the other thing I wanted to unpack is that you mentioned this mentor of
okay,
yours.
Yeah.
And you were sharing a studio.
Yes.
I can't harp enough on how important mentors are.
True.
I mean, what did this was a, what was his name again?
Scott Hamilton.
What did he mean to you? What was it like? What was that? What's your relationship like to this day? I mean, how much further along are you today, would you say, because you had a mentor as opposed to if you were just on your own?
I actually personally have thanked him. Like, so now I have my own studio, of course. But the idea was, especially when I was learning art, learning photography specifically, and I actually posted on social media, like, I need a studio space. It's been difficult for me to find a space. And so he actually messaged me on social media and said, like, oh, I have a space. I'll be willing to share. And so I actually was learning photography during the pandemic. So 2019, I started photography, but 2020 is actually when I was like really learning like all the ins and outs of photography, learning about my camera, learning about lighting. And so he was very pivotal in me learning about lighting and studio lighting specifically. He's actually a photography professor at RIT currently. And so, and he's actually known, I think, in the world of advertisement for a lot of the advertising he did in the 90s and the 2000s. And he's very successful and accomplished. And so learning from him really helped to inform my art today, I believe. Learning about all the different types of lighting and modifiers, as many people might know, in photography, they use like the umbrellas and the different shapes to really hone in your light and make it focused. Scott Hamilton was very integral to my learning photography. And actually, I'm putting in the next run of the book like a list of the people who have been integral to my art and art journey. So my series, Black is Beautiful, a book has been launched. About 250 photos are featured in the book, and it's available now on my website. And so I'm doing like batches of 50 and doing small batch printing. And for the next launch of the next batch, I will be having a list of all the people who have supported my art journey.
The book is called Black is Beautiful, or that's the series, or that's the
book?
Or?
That's the book.
That's the book, Black is Beautiful. Mm-hmm. So tell me about that. That's your lived experience. Obviously, yes. You're an African-American gentleman, right? But that's your lived experience. Tell me how you, when you were going to finally publish, that was the road that you wanted to go down. That's your inspiration. Bring me there through that
journey. Yes, so actually the print that I gifted you has the model who started the idea of Black is Beautiful. So the story is that I was going to practice my photography, do a photo shoot with her, and we were talking, and she was telling me how it's very rare for her to take her photo. She doesn't normally like to take her photo because all throughout her young years and her friends and family, even her mother would say that she was too black, that she was like ugly or different because her skin is so dark. And then I told her, I said, but black is beautiful. And so that was like the birth of the idea. Like, how can someone who I feel is so beautiful and like is actually one of the most beautiful people that I've ever seen feeling this way? And so that's where the idea of Black is Beautiful came, just to make people with dark skin and who have those type of feelings in their life to feel that they don't have to feel that way anymore, because I truly believe that dark skin is the most beautiful and actually the best type of skin to photograph. Because when I was learning photography, I learned that lighting is important. And when you're a new photographer, you're still learning light. And so because I was using so much light and like, I used to notice that lighter skinned people would be blown out or like the color would go away. But the darker your skin, the more light you can use and the easier it was for me to learn about photography because you need so much light. So I actually preferred photographing darker skinned people because I could use as much light as possible.
That's fantastic. I mean, light has come up several times, and that was a big thing that your mentor helped you with. And it sounds like I know just from watching TikToks, of these little videos that go like, why do your TikToks look like shit? One word, lighting. Exactly. So I obviously, even I don't know anything about the world of photography, but I know lighting is important. I get that. A few photo shoots we've done, they bring in a million lights, you know, that's the big thing. And that's interesting that black is beautiful, which is such a profound thing to say. It's such a profound feeling, but it's also just like a technical thing where you're saying like, hey, I love lighting. Lighting is important to my job, and lighting looks better on black skin than it does on white skin.
I didn't say that exactly.
What? I said that? Hold on. Sorry. Hold on.
Black is beautiful to me means so many different things.
Okay.
It specifically means black is beautiful to the model, like your skin is beautiful, but also means that to everybody. And I want the book actually to be for not just black people. The idea that you are beautiful, to me, that's what black is beautiful means. And that's what I was telling the model on that day, that no matter what anybody says, you are beautiful because you're Black, because you are you. So that's what I really want people to take away from the idea of that, that no matter who you are, no matter where you come from, because you're alive, because you're human, because of your experiences in life, that's what makes you beautiful.
Yeah, yeah. It kind of reminds me, it makes me think about this phrase that I love people say, everybody is the good guy in their version of the story. There are very few people in this world, there's some, don't get me wrong, but there's very few people in this world who are just truly evil people. Mm. Most people are the good guy or the good girl in their version of the story. So True. No matter what, you are beautiful. I love that sentiment. It's exactly right.
Yes. Yeah. The model that I've actually have at the very last page of the book says, you are a work of art.
Oh.
And so that's the last thing you see before you close the book. And I really want the book to be a testament and a statement for everyone to feel that way, that you are beautiful, you're a work of art. No matter if you feel you have flaws or imperfections.
Which, by the way, every human being alive has flaws and imperfections, right? Exactly. Like, nobody's perfect.
Or maybe they're not flaws and imperfections. Maybe that's what...
Are you saying people are perfect? See,
I
this
think per- I might. Perfect has, like, the idea of, like, what is perfect to you is different than what is perfect to me. So perfect is relative, really.
Fair. Okay. No, so I can meet you on middle ground there, because I do feel that, I'm full of my corny sayings today, but there's another saying that says something like the expectation of perfection is noble. The pursuit of perfection is The pursuit of perfection is noble. The expectation of perfection is foolish. Mm. That's a saying that I've heard that I like.
Yeah.
Because it's basically saying, like, nobody's perfect and, you know, we all have room for improvement and stuff. But what you're saying, it's okay.
True.
We're kind of...
I really believe perfect can be based on whoever you're asking. Because even like if you just say a basic idea like weather, the perfect weather for you is not the perfect weather for me. That's the perfect temperature.
Well, we've discussed, we don't like any weather.
Exactly. I like being indoors. Someone likes going biking all day. So that's the perfect life for them. So perfect means different things to everybody.
What about these people that go camping? What is wrong with these people? No, those people are imperfect. You know what I'm saying?
See, like they have a perfect life. If they want to go camping every weekend, they should do that.
You're right. Okay, let's get into the nuts and bolts of actually being like, okay, I'm going to take these photos. I'm going to come out with a book. Bring me to the light bulb moment for, you know what I'm going to do? A book. What's the light bulb moment?
Okay, so the idea came from, I'm growing as a photographer over these past few years, and I started doing a gallery shows, like, or showing my work to the public, or people wanting to see my, like, so the idea was that I was showing my work on social media, like I post regularly, weekly, but then people were saying, like, how do I see your work in person? I only know you from being on social media. So I had my first like gallery exhibition idea in 2021. And so after that, people were saying they wanted to see my work in person. And so when I started doing that, like showing my work in the community, I exhibited at the Central Library, Jiva Theater once before in 2023. And I didn't have anything physical to give people. So people were able to now meet me in person or see my art on the wall. But then I think I felt, and people wanted something like tangible that they could like maybe take home. And at the time I didn't have prints or anything physical that I could give them. And so, that's when the idea of a book came about. And I wanted like a physical something that people could have and it could last forever, potentially. And they could see all of the work that I have created over the past 7 years now. And so I thought a book was the best way to showcase that as well, because I have literally thousands of images I've taken. When I was practicing photography, I used to take photos like almost every other day. And so in my phone, as digital files, I have like 50,000 images. And social media is not always the best way to show your work as a photographer, because it's not tangible. So I thought a book would be the best way I could show a mass amount of my work, or at least a good portion of it. But then also people could have it for their homes and reference it through their daily life.
How many photos in the book?
It has over 250.
250 photos. Are they your 250 best? Or did you, when you decided to do a book, did you set out and take 250 new photos?
Oh, no. So it's 250 images through my career, I would say. From 2019. So images that I took from 2019 when I first started photography up until this year.
Anything from 2019 make it in the book? Like the early days? Yes. Those first photo? Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, some of those images are some of my best photos.
Nice.
I would say that I really like.
That's great. Yeah. And is it all people? It's all portraits?
All portraits. About 70 models.
Okay.
And then a range of ages. So I have pregnant mothers that are like maternity idea, and then the oldest person is Dr. Walter Cooper, who was 95 when I took his photo.
Awesome.
Actually just recently posted that he was the first black scientist at Kodak, so he's like a local legend, and
yeah,
he's 95 when I took his photo. He's now 97 years old, so he's definitely
that's cool.
Big accomplishment for me taking his photo.
What about the actual business of getting a book printed? You got to go find a printer, and there's cost to that. There's proofing stages. Like, what was that part like for you?
So I'm actually in that journey currently. So the first print run of books, I did just 50. But that book that I printed was a soft cover book, and so now I had to find a printer that does hardcover, different type of pages and the thickness of pages. And well, I've learned that printing books in America is very expensive, so now I'm trying to find maybe like a lower cost printer overseas. Mm-hmm. Those ideas, because I really want as many people as possible to be able to have access to the book and to be able to afford the book. And so I have to navigate that world of like, how much the book costs to print? Is it hardcover or softcover? Can people afford it in their day-to-day life? So yes, it's been a journey learning mm-hmm. about the publishing process and maybe how to get my book in the library. I was trying to figure that out. And you need an ISBN number. And how do you get your book into Amazon so that I don't have to like ship all the books from my room, you know?
Yeah. So I feel you.
It's definitely a journey.
By the way, you're overlooking our warehouse right now. Yes. Our first shipping facility was my father-in-law's living room coffee table.
Yes, that's most people when they start a business. So yes, it's been a difficult journey, but it's actually, I found that what I'm moving from is from an artist, like a practicing artist day to day, like creating art, to more of like I feel more of an entrepreneur, where you're like creating a product, or like the more the day to day logistics of like how to make money from your art, or how to like advertise your art, or how to get people to know that a book even exists. So I thank you for this opportunity now to be able to reach people and let them know about my website, adameaton.com. Because really I want this book, Black is Beautiful, to reach as many people as possible. And so that's the journey I'm on now. So I think I've created lots of work, and I have a positive message that I want to share with the world. So now my goal is to share the message of Black is Beautiful to as many people as possible.
So you've done one run, 50 books, or you've done multiple runs already? Or
just one.
Just the one. And are there any of those still available for purchase?
So that run is sold out at the launch event.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's great.
And so now I want to, I'm getting the funds to do the next print run.
Okay. All right. And you're also kind of looking for a printer, though, it sounds like. I have a printer. Oh, you're good on the printer. Okay. So, that's a hell of a thing to learn. You know, what I do is contract manufacturing. It's a hell of a thing to find somebody to do in this case, manufacturing, the printing. But it's the same idea. It's manufacturing.
Okay, like you were talking about earlier about the quality.
Yeah.
And you want people to, every book to be of high quality. And,
mm-hmm. it really matters for you too. Like you were talking about the thickness of the page. I mean, when you're talking about these beautiful portraits, like you can't just be the cheapest paper, the cheapest everything. It's got to be like, it's got to be good, high quality stuff. And it's interesting too to me to hear me, and I don't know how I feel about it. We might argue a little bit, but it's interesting for me to hear you that you don't want to charge a lot of money for the book. I understand where your heart's at. I get where your heart is at because you're saying, I want everyone to be able to get their hands on this book. And if it's a $50 book or what, I mean, what, how much was the book, by the way?
So at the launch event, because of the high printing cost, I had to sell it for $85.
Yeah, that here's the thing. I think that's okay. I think that's perfectly fine. Were you getting a lot of angst? Well, you sold out, Adam. You sold out.
I did, but I think a lot of my supporters are, they maybe like either could save or have the funds to do it. But I want everyone to be able to, and whether you have the funds or maybe you're a family with lots of kids, or maybe you're inner city youth. Mm-hmm. I don't want it to be out of reach for all those people too.
So for the people to whom $85 is nothing or not a lot of money, this is why I think you should charge more. Because imagine you had charged all those people $100. Because to them, no big deal, right? $100, easy, right? You're saying you've got supporters like that, and that's great. That extra money that you charged could go towards being able to donate some books or sell some books at a lower price. I understand there has to be a retail price if you're going to be in Wegmans or Barnes & Noble or whatever. It's got to have a retail price. But then if you want to go into the inner city and make sure people have access to this, the fact that you were charging $100 a book gives you the ability then to have some books to then go and donate around.
I am working on those ideas. I was thinking of like the idea of like if people who can like could buy a book and then one other book is donated, those type of programs I've seen in business. But yes, that's my goal, just to make it sure as accessible as possible, get maybe the book into libraries. Yeah, that's a goal of mine. Great. I want even young people, without, like a lot of young people in high school don't have a job and they can't afford it, but I want them to be able to have the book in their homes as well. So yeah, we'll see. I'm working on the idea of sponsorship and maybe having business sponsor.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
So yeah.
Two things to add, give me some advice from a manufacturer.
Yes, I have lots of ideas.
The more books you print, the cheaper they're going to be. That's
true.
Another thing.
So that's what I'm working on.
Yeah,
so.
Yeah. But
I'm learning
cash.
That the small batch idea of 50 here, 50 there is actually not the best way to do it.
Yeah, right. Right. If you can print... You know, this is probably crazy. If you can print 1,000, you got this big cash outlay, which sucks. True. But your per unit cost will go way down if you can do that.
So that's why I'm looking for the idea of sponsors.
Yeah.
I actually would be okay with having like even Vogue magazine have sponsors in the beginning of the book. And that will help to offset the cost so that I could have then the sponsor. I would say I'm printing 1,000 books. Your advertisement would be just so as many people can see this book and the message of Black is Beautiful as possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, your heart, your brain is, you're all in the right place. You're doing it right. You're doing it right. You don't need my crappy advice.
No, but, you're great.
The other thing too with your manufacturer, whoever's printing, terms. If you go back, did they make you pay up front the first time?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay, see how good of a customer I am? I paid you up front the first time. This time, net 30. I'll pay in 30 days.
Okay.
That's another one. That way you can actually get positive cash flow. So you start selling some of those books. And so some of the money from the books will actually go to pay the printer.
Correct.
So we shouldn't say what we do here. I've heard other manufacturing places do maybe first order, you have to pay up front. We have to establish that you're actually good for this, right?
Yes.
Second order, 50-50. You pay half of it up front. The other half I'll give you net 30 on. And then from the third order on, you can just have net 30 terms. You pay me 30 days. But it lets you get ahead of the money that you owe. You go out into the world, sell those books. And now you're actually, you're positive cash roll. You know what I'm saying?
It's interesting that I'm now in this world of like being an artist, creating art, and not even making money from it. And now I'm like talking about net 30 and manufacturing. And that's the way of America.
I guess. An entrepreneur, bro. You're an entrepreneur, whether you like it or not. And that's it. You know, you're doing it. So the idea now is to get more and more books printed and get them into the hands of as many people as possible. If we think beyond Black is Beautiful, do you have an idea yet what the future holds? What's the 5 to 10 year plan?
Maybe a volume 2. I know people want that. Yeah. And also I do. So I'm in a reflection period now of my art and my career. So I've I've done a lot of work and I've had a creative journey, and I want to reflect and celebrate that journey. And that's really what this book is, like a reflection of like everything that I've gone through and gone past and made better and improved my life and become happier and connected with the community. This book is basically a culmination of all that goodness and all that happiness and a celebration. So I want to celebrate for a few years, but then after that, I'm sure I'll want to start creating more again. And maybe there'll be a volume two.
That's great. Yeah. Is my wife correct when she says that if I hold the camera up at this angle, right up high, like up in the sky, and I take the picture down on myself, that I look 10 pounds lighter? Is that true?
She is true.
Yeah. That's okay, right. Good. That's a good trick true. Then. She knows. Is my sister-in-law correct that when she takes a selfie that she should take 150 selfies before she finds the perfect one?
I would say she's right.
Okay. I watch, you're and never, man, the amount of reps she's taken, but I guess that's the right way to do it, right? That's how you find the perfect shot.
Well, so okay. I've taken more than 50,000 photos, so I definitely understand that idea.
So like this beautiful portrait I'm looking at, right? Your cover right here. This beautiful. How many shots that are just like that did you take? And then how long did it take you to go through those and say, that's the one?
So most photo shoots, the average is about 500 photos. That's like minimum.
Uh-huh.
And it normally can go up to 1,000 per photo shoot.
And then you comb through them one by one by one?
One by one, yes.
And then what do? You check like the ones you think are good and then you...
Yeah, so everything is, I use, I take the photos and I digitally transfer them to my iPhone to the cloud. And so then I just sit for hours and go through.
Yeah, yeah. And then
when pick the best.
You narrow it down to 10, then you narrow it down to 5, and then you... Like, is there a photo that's...
The book was so hard to pick.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it literally took months because I had to go through from 2019.
Damn.
Almost every image I took and then cut that down to 250. It was one of the hardest things I've ever done.
This is almost going to sound like a joke, but I swear to God, I am legitimately asking this question. Can you give advice to regular people, me right now, and then whoever's listening, on how to take good photos with our phones? You're out in public and you just want to take a picture with your family or something. Like, is there anything you can do in the moment? I mean, lighting, right? Like, look for
true,
good lighting.
That's the main thing. So make sure the light is always in front of you.
Okay.
Not behind you, for sure. And so make and the angle too is important. The angle of the light. You so don't want right. light coming from above you.
Yeah, yeah.
You want it to be coming like diagonal.
Diagonally at you.
But front.
Diagonally
like a key
front.
Light. Like that's the idea of a key light.
Okay. All right, got it. Okay, I like it. Okay. Last question. When you get gastric bypass surgery, do the cravings go away or do you just get like beat into submission over time where you're like,
it does actually.
It does like immediately because, yeah, or
it cuts your stomach away.
Yeah, yeah. So you don't want cheeseburgers anymore or you're like, I do want them, but I can't eat them. And eventually I learned not to
eat it. Well, for me, I guess everyone's different. But the idea was that I would literally get sick if you overeat, mm-hmm, especially mm-hmm. in like the first year.
Yeah.
And that's where you mainly lose the most of the weight, like the first year, year and a half. So yeah, you can't eat. It's similar to the idea of the GLP-1s where your stomach is no longer, because they cut your stomach away, it's not producing the ghrelin that makes you hungry.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So your stomach is like just, I think they said the size of like a egg or
damn,
really tiny. So you're not creating the hormone that makes you hungry.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you can't physically eat because you'll be sick.
I've been on Wegovy now for months and I've lost about 50 pounds, but I have kind of plateaued around the 50 pound mark, I've realized. Which
that's actually, the drug is not made to lose more than 50 pounds.
Oh, there we go.
Like
there.
20% of your overall body weight.
Okay. I don't know math.
Maybe you should look into the idea of gastric bypass.
My doctor told me that actually when I was trying to push him on Ozempic or Wegovy or whatever, my doctor was like, maybe we should look at gastric bypass. To me, it was scary because it's surgery, right?
True.
But at the end of the day, I mean, that was, my doctor was really saying that. He was saying it's closer to natural than the GLP-1s are. Because I think also with GLP-1s, isn't there some talk about, hey, we really don't know long-term if these things are okay for you or not?
Well, I really believe that, like, if you're losing, need to lose over 100 pounds, the way you should do it is the gastric bypass, which is made to help you lose 100 pounds, and then the GLP-1s will help you to maintain it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because over time, your stomach will stretch from after having the surgery, and a lot of those food cravings come back.
Yeah.
So that's when you should use the GLP-1s to maintain the weight. But if you need to lose over 100 pounds, you have to do that. Then it's really hard to do it without like surgery or like 2 years of like willpower, which can be very difficult for people. So surgery and then maintaining it with the GLP. But talk to your doctor, of course, for those ideas.
Yeah, yeah. All right, anything I missed? What didn't I ask you? What are you like, I can't believe you didn't ask me about this?
If you want to learn more about me or purchase my book, go to adameaton.com. Really, I just want people to know that that Black people are not other, are not different. All of us that live in America, I know that a lot of times there are, especially nowadays, about like immigration and racism and discrimination. Really, I want people to have the idea that everyone should be treated as a human. Everyone is equal. No one's different. Your skin color doesn't make you worse. It doesn't make you better. And for some reason, I think America has a hard time with that idea. I'm sure it's just the years of like segregation and discrimination, but I really do believe that if people really want to change their mind and their mindset, they can do it. And hopefully this book, Black is Beautiful, helps people to move towards a more positive view of people and community and just humanity in general.
Tough time in this country right now too. True. You know, it feels it's tough though.
But we really have the power. We really have the power to make decisions for our life and what we'll believe, and just the idea that all humans deserve good things. All humans deserve a positive life. All humans deserve opportunity. So if we can all change to that mindset, I think the world will be a much better place.
That's the perfect way to end the podcast. There's nothing I can do to, nothing I should. I should just shut up and say, you know what, Adam? That was perfect. Thank you for coming out to Bergen and doing this.
Thank you for this opportunity. Of course. You're doing great things for the community.
Oh, that's so nice of you to say. That's so nice. I appreciate that. And I'm so thankful for you came out. Thank you for this beautiful gift too. I'm gonna hang it somewhere around here. I think I'm gonna put it in my office actually.
Do that.
Oh yeah. Thanks, Adam. Thanks for doing this. Good luck with the book. Black is Beautiful. AdamEaton.com. AdamEatonArt.com.
AdamEaton.com.
AdamEaton.com.